This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
I'm not that much of a nightlife person. I mean, I am in that nightlife for me is just life. I'm nocturnal. I live my life at night. But when we typically think of nightlife, we think about people that go out partying until the wee hours of the morning, going out to bars and nightclubs. I never like nightclubs. I like the quiet lounge. And I'm talking about when I was in my heyday and even still now. Nothing has changed from when I was 18 till now. I like the quiet lounge where you can have a drink, have a nice conversation, and where the music is not so loud that you can't think, and where these places are not so crowded that you can't move. That's my jam. And unfortunately, you know, there are places like that are few and far between. But anyway, there's an interesting trend going on in Shanghai right now. And I think it's worth looking at and wondering if this is one of these things that starts out in a foreign country and comes here eventually. More people in Shanghai are choosing to forego traditional nightlife spots, like what I just mentioned, bars, restaurants, nightclubs, and so forth, and instead pay to drink and socialize at strangers' homes. The trend involves converting a personal residence into a bar and charging customers an entrance fee for unlimited drinks. The Chinese outlet Sixth Tone reported about this uptick in trends of what they're calling home bars. These home bars have become very popular among office workers who feel out of place in the city's typical bars and clubs and prefer a laid-back, house party-like environment. Owners and hosts are facing some serious challenges, though, including licensing requirements. This is why this would never work in New York. And heightened competition as this trend is taking off. Some are adding extra entertainment to attract customers. You imagine this? These people that have these home bars are trying to outdo one another. It's becoming less and less casual, more and more of a business. One host said he transformed a bedroom into a mahjong room and sometimes invites astrologers and tarot readers. I have to tell you, not only do I love this idea, not only would I go to one of these parties, but I could see this taking off in America. I think this is really interesting. And I mean, I guess people have parties from time to time. And, you know, I've been to a lot of parties at people's houses or people's apartments over the years. And they kind of turn into a thing where you just show up, even if you don't necessarily know the person throwing the party. But I don't think it has caught on anywhere in America to the extent that it has in Shanghai like this. And I kind of like this. I think this could do well here. Obviously, there's all sorts of hurdles here, like licensing requirements and beer and liquor licenses and that kind of thing. I don't know how you get around that. I think it probably would have to at least start out as sort of an underground thing, kind of a home speakeasy sort of a thing. But I think if this was the kind of thing that developed on, say, TikTok, I think it could do very well, very well. All right, coming up in about 5 minutes, I am going to talk with celebrated trial attorney Norm Pattis, one of the most controversial trial attorneys in America. on a criminal basis and on a civil basis, no one has had more high-profile cases than I'm aware of than Norm Pattiz. And I interviewed Norm, what year is it? 2024. 13 years ago. That was the last time we spoke, 13 years ago. And as is often the case, when you interview someone, they send you the book. And I put this book in a stack of books that I would get to one day. Well, one day came, and I just finished reading the book, and I loved it. I loved it. I had some issues with it, some problems with it. I am going to bring them up with Norm. But I loved the focus on the jury system that Norm has in this book. And that's what we're going to get into, because so many times people have asked me, get me out of jury duty. Not that I have the power to do this, but they think I do for some reason. They ask me, get me out of jury duty. Get me out of jury duty. And I'm so offended, and I don't offend easily, when people ask me to get them out of jury duty, because to me, it's so lazy, number one. The country doesn't ask a lot of you, and jury service is one of the few things that they ask of you. And two, I think it's such a rotten thing to do to everybody that's involved in the justice system that depends on your participation to get a fair or equitable outcome. So I'm going to bring some of that up with Norm Pattiz in just a minute. Meanwhile, speaking of the criminal justice system, you have to check out the latest edition of the Racket Report. My guest was author and historian Jeffrey Sussman. We spoke about his new book, Tinseltown Gangsters, and the mob, the rise and decline of the mob in Hollywood. Here's a snippet of my conversation with Jeff Sussman. When and why did the mob first become involved in Hollywood?
Well, initially Al Capone was kind of interested, but really didn't follow up on it. But Joseph Kennedy Sr. Had an opportunity to buy a small company called FOB, which was an importer and an exporter, and he bought the company. He needed he borrowed some money from his father-in-law, and he borrowed money from the owner of Filene's department store in Boston, but it wasn't enough. And he had been dealing with mobsters in bootlegging, and he was able to borrow the balance of the money from the Chicago outfit. And he paid all the money back, but the outfit then realized, after a Kennedy's experience, that there was gold in their hills. And you know, they followed shortly thereafter.
I have to tell you, I thought this was a fascinating conversation. I had no idea Joe Kennedy was so integral into Hollywood and the mob at that time. Please listen to the whole podcast. You can go to redapplepodcastnetwork.com, just search The Racket Report, or search The Racket Report on any podcast app, iTunes or Google Podcasts, anything. Search The Racket Report, hit the subscribe button, and if you want to help spread the visibility of the podcast, not only should you subscribe, but give us a 5-star rating and write a nice review. That'll help more people discover it. All right. Norm Pattiz joins me straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Hi, it's Ernie Anastas. You know, your thoughts can affect how you feel, and how you feel can impact your thoughts. Addressing your mind and body connection is the key to improving your overall wellness. Bergen Newbridge Medical Center is the largest hospital in New Jersey, providing comprehensive, equitable, compassionate, and high-quality emergency inpatient and outpatient medical care, plus mental health services and substance use disorder treatment. The Bergen Newbridge team can address your total health needs in one convenient location. Call 201-225-7130. For an appointment, or newbridgehealth.org.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. There's been a lot of legal issues in the news. Obviously, we've been talking about the Trump trials or the Trump litigation. We've been talking about Sam Bankman-Fried. But it's interesting. I have covered a number of trials on the radio in the course of my life. Going to the courtroom and watching these trials take place has been just fascinating. Civil trials, criminal trials. But these are fewer and fewer and farther in between. We're almost at the point these days where whenever I talk to a lawyer, one of the first questions that I'll ask them, and I'm not talking about a lawyer that has just started, I'm talking about lawyers that have practiced for a few years, several years now, is I'll ask, how many cases have you tried, whether they're criminal trials or civil trials? How many cases that you've been tried have you tried? And you will see lawyer after lawyer say one, two, maybe three or four. And that's not a reflection of me socializing with inexperienced lawyers. It is a reflection of the fact that the criminal justice system today and the court system in general today does everything in the world to discourage trials. And if those trials do happen, fewer and fewer of them involve a jury of one's peers. So I remembered a book that I had from an interview that I had conducted about 12 or 13 years ago. The book is basically a love letter to juries, and it's a clarion call to the system, whatever form that takes, to have more juries and broader use of the jury system. The book was called Juries and Justice: Saving a System Under Fire. And since it was written over a decade ago, the idea of a jury trial has become rarer and rarer. Very pleased to welcome the author of that book. He's been called one of America's most controversial and successful trial attorneys. He's had scores of high-profile criminal defendants, saving a lot of people from going to prison. He's also won multi-million-dollar civil judgments many times over and has appeared as an expert legal commentator on nearly every national media outlet of note. Very pleased to welcome to the program Norm Pattis. Norm, it's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out, Frank. It's good to talk to you. I've missed you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Hey, people may be familiar with the legal system through shows like Perry Mason or Matlock, or even more modern shows like Boston Legal, and they see that it's not an unusual thing for cases to go to trial, and they may hear me or read your book and think that, what do you mean these cases don't go to trial? Explain to folks, Norm, why cases may not end up going to trial and why that's becoming increasingly rare.
Yeah, so you're talking about problems that lawyers and legal scholars and judges recognize as the vanishing trial. Why is it that trials are taking place with decreasing frequency? I'll focus on the criminal side because, you know, there are different dynamics and different reasons on both civil and criminal. And if you want to pivot to civil at some point, just flick the switch. Sure. And we'll do so. But the German philosopher Immanuel Kant once said that two things filled him with wonder: the starry heavens above, that is, looking out of the nighttime sky and seeing all the stars and realizing that for all the struggle, stress, and storm of our lives, we are but a speck in an infinite universe, infinitely vast in space and infinitely long in time. And that's sort of an overwhelming feeling, and an awe-inspiring feeling. And then there is the moral law within, where we come up with our intuitions of justice, of truth, and beauty, and how it is that we're calibrated to reach these conclusions, and how we make life-defining and life-defending choices based on these. And so he said these two things filled him with awe. There's a third thing that I view as equally awesome, and that is the fact of our public lives together, the fact of government. And you're saying, oh, come on, there's nothing awesome about the DMV. And you're damn right, there isn't. The most awesome thing about most administrative agencies is the feeling you get when you got to go to them. The fact of government can best be considered in the following way. How is it that perfect strangers acquire a right that you respect to tell you to do something? That sense, that's what's called the sense of legitimacy. And so legitimacy is a third magical quality in the universe, together with the sense of significance in the face of the infinite, with a sense of orientation or fit in our world, and then significance in our communities. And what am I talking about? Let's use a really silly example. You're standing on the street corner today, a guy sticks something in your ribs and says, give me your wallet. You turn around, it's a stranger, he's got a gun. Odds are you will give him that wallet, mm-hmm. not because you think it's the right thing to do, but because you're afraid. So change the hypothetical somewhat, put him in a police uniform, he's got a badge on, says, show me your wallet. Doesn't think, give me, or maybe he says, give me. You might give him the wallet out of the same sense of fear, but you might also show him the respect that comes of the badge. In other words, you might recognize he has more than just power or authority. So how do we transfer authority in the United States? We are, you know, a constitutional democratic republic. We vote. People get placed in offices. Those offices have meets and bounds. In other words, they can go so far and not another. And the lawyers argue about how to distribute this power, this authority, and how it can be rightly used. Jury systems are where the jury system in a criminal case is where we put this system in action. And we say to ordinary people, you make the call. So how does a criminal case begin? In the United States, we have penal codes, that is, laws that list what and define crimes. In Connecticut, where I'm sitting right now, murder is the specific intent or conscious objective to cause a death, the death of another person, and then causing that death. That's against the law, whatever that means. That's against something. Prosecutors read that law, and then police officers bring the facts, things that occur in the world on the street to them, and they say, do these facts amount to that crime? And if so, should we prosecute? Lawyers step in to play adversarial roles in this system, in the system of determining the truth, whether a law was broken or not. And jury trials is where this is put on public display. And we say in the United States that this is such an important function. We're going to let we the people, the authors of our sovereignty, the folks who arguably and allegedly created our government, at least under our theory, we're going to let them make this decision. And so a jury trial is a place of great dignity. It's a place where the mystery of our public life is played out. It's a place where we test fundamental ideas and notions about ourselves and our place, not necessarily in the universe, but in the society we inhabit in the universe. It's that place where we test these and we test the limits of these. And any trial, no matter how significant or insignificant, you know, whether it be over a park or a speeding ticket or a murder, every trial takes place under this more or less same rules and procedures. And a lawyer's role is to represent the interest of his or her clients before a jury. In an adversarial system, which is what we have in the United States, the belief is that the contest, the fight between the two lawyers will lead to the truth. Jurors will be able to decide for themselves which version of events to believe. And so jury trials are combustible. In my view, the republic is recreated anew in each and every verdict, and they nourish civic life, which is why in the pre-internet era, you know, television or not, and pre-television era, trials were great sources of entertainment. Mm. You know, hundreds of people would turn up to watch Clarence Darrow argue. They moved the Scopes Monkey trial that pitted Darrow against William Jennings Bryan. I think it was in Newport, Tennessee. They moved it out of the building, and I may be wrong on the location of the town. I'm sorry I said that. But they moved it out of the courthouse into the public square so that more people could watch in the heat of the summer. You know, and it's been memorialized in the book Twilight of the Gods. So it's a long answer that I give you, but I wanted to set the fundamentals mm-hmm. of what a trial is. Why are they decreasing? Plea bargaining is a significant factor. The expense of trial is a significant factor. The fact that we have so many crimes and prosecutors have such broad discretion to try them, and there's such an overwhelming number of cases is another factor. I think a decline of confidence, and I'm not so sure about this, but I wonder whether a declining sense of legitimacy in the United States, given how polarized we are, is another factor. You know, there's so much hatred in the air right yep. now of everyone and everything, and I wonder how that is, because we don't live lives of hate. We live lives where we love one another. We presumably and hopefully love ourselves and care for ourselves. We love the people with whom we are intimate. We show respect to others, and we have a commitment to our community. These are all positive attributes. But the face we show to the world in social media is uniformly hostile and angry.
Right.
How did that disconnect take place? And what are we going to do about it? And is that disconnect in part related to the decline in jury trials? I don't know. This is the first time I've thought about it in that way.
That's really interesting. We have a lot of people in our audience right now all over the country that I guarantee you have done something to try to get out of jury service. They've either tried to know someone or they've tried to make up an excuse. Speak to those people. Speak to the people that view jury service as not just an inconvenience but a burden to be avoided at all costs. And a lot of them are quite cynical. As you know, a lot of people who are up at this time of the night, especially in cities like New York or Baltimore or St. Louis, they come to believe that they can't necessarily make a difference. What difference does it make if I go to a jury service or not when I have to take time off from work, take time off from my family? Speak to those folks as to why they should embrace jury duty.
Every step you take is draped in a sense of community. You know, Hillary Clinton once says it takes a village to raise a child, and there's the old philosophical conundrum: what came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, would the individual or the community? We don't know, but there's not a person listening to this radio who isn't radically dependent on others. Even the most isolated person who sleeps all day, is heavily medicated, is perhaps thinking of a gun to the mouth as a solution to life's woes. And I know some of you out there are doing that. Even these people need community. You don't grow your own food. You don't tend your own utility lines. You don't create, generally speaking, your own heat. And community is drenched in a sense of settled expectations. Settled expectations is what the rule of law governs. In other words, we have communities that in which we can know what to expect when we leave the door, know what to expect when we go to buy milk at the grocery store, know what to expect when we call the pharmacist to fill our doctor's prescriptions, know what to expect when we go to the doctor. Mm. These are all governed by norms, rules, regulations, and common sets of expectations. Jurors are called in to evaluate the government's claim that someone's conduct broke those expectations and pose a threat to the community. We don't lynch people. We don't run them out of town. We don't tar and feather. We make communal judgments about whether someone has erred and whether they've erred in a way that requires the community to act. I cannot imagine a more important role for any citizen to take than in making that judgment. Because you, as a juror, are selected more or less at random from the community. You're vetted by being questioned by the various sides. And the question is, can you speak on behalf of all of us as to whether the government is right in its accusations? And because we say that our sense of legitimacy, our government was created by consent in this country, you're being invited into a seat every bit as powerful as that of the founding fathers. Because what you will do with your verdict is you will recreate a sense of legitimacy, a sense of right in the community. You will sit in judgment not of the defendant, but of the government. You know, a big mistake that people make when they walk into a criminal court is they look over at the defense table and they say, I wonder what that guy did. The real question is, I wonder what the government's accused and what can it prove? Because jurors are the community's check on the power of government. And so I think for those of you inclined to duck jury service, I would say be careful what you wish for. You get the government you deserve. And if the government, if you refuse to play your role, then you deserve to be mistreated because the power is yours. And if you refuse to use it, someone else will, and don't complain about how they use it if you're not prepared to share it.
Well said. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Norm Pattis, a veteran trial attorney. If you're thinking of committing a crime or suing someone, you could check out his website at normpattis.com. Or if you're interested in learning more about the jury system, you could check out several of his books, including the one that I just finished reading. Again, Juries and Justice, Saving a System Under Fire. Norm, you make such a powerful case in the book and in our conversation now about the importance of juries and of trials, and I agree with a great deal of what you write in the book, but so much of your book is kind of a response to oligarchy, a response to the increasingly undemocratic nature of life and government in the United States these days. One area which I don't know that I understand, because it seems a little inconsistent with that, is you call at one point for all judges to be appointed for life. Why? Doesn't that make judges even more monarchical?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, as to the book, it was written quickly and as part of a multi book contract. And so there's much that I would do differently and perhaps say differently now 10, 12 years ago later. And I fit my law license is may temporarily be suspended because of the Alex Jones case.
Oh, I'm going to ask you about that at this time. Yeah.
And so I may sit down and write another book, and it may be on this topic. But here is the case for lifetime appointment. Life is strife, as Roosevelt once said, and a lawyer's life is stressful all day long. I have a number of people who work for me, and about, I think, eight or nine right now. I have to stop and think about it. And I always tell them, you know, I can look stupid on my own. Your job is to help me look good and help me get all this work done. And so our phone rings constantly. We get, 50 calls a week from people looking, maybe more some weeks, to be represented in one thing or another. And it's an exhausting and overwhelming thing to respond to these calls, because everybody who calls is in need. They're not calling because they think I'm an entertaining guy. They're calling because they want my help. And so I have to decide who to help and why. And many times people come to this office because they've made trouble for themselves. They're an imperfect fit in their community. It could be a characterological issue. It could be a mental health issue. It could just be a horribly bad day. It could be the community was wrong. And so the lack of fit requires a lawyer to try to make everything fit within the rule of law. Lawyers often say, when they're being honest among themselves and no one is listening, that the practice of law would be great if it weren't for the clients. Because what it is an infinitely interesting puzzle. And how all those pieces fit together is the job of a judge to determine. Lifetime appointment to a judiciary means that a person, the judge, is truly independent of voters, is truly independent of the legislature, is truly independent of the executive branch. And in the United States, we have the concept in our federal and every state constitution, I believe, of the separation of powers. We say that when powers are separated and divided, no one is absolute. The checks and balances make room for liberty. And thus, in the United States, we have limited government. The judiciary plays a vital role in that. And so, many years ago, when Sonia Sotomayor before she was on her way to the Supreme Court, she was a judge at the Second Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And she once called me down to meet her on a non-case related basis and asked me, had I ever thought about becoming a federal judge? She said, you've got a lot of support here in New York, and you'd be a great judge. And the Obama administration is going to be looking for people, criminal defense lawyers and civil rights attorneys, to do so. And we talked, and I considered it and gave a lot of thought to whether to do it. And the appeal of it was the following. It would almost be a priestly dedication to a grand game, as it were, the fitting together of as many pieces of the puzzle into a coherent whole as could be possible. So the best job in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, Supreme Court justice, because what you have there is the highest quality conflicts about unsettled issues, and the judges are responsible for considering in isolation the scope and sweep of American law and making all of the pieces fit as best they can. And some of the best legal talent in the United States appears before them to argue their respective cases about this. Anytime you inject a third party's influence into that process, you disturb it, and it becomes warped by the idiosyncratic interests of the individuals who are, influencing people. Consider, the great controversy now about whether Clarence Thomas has been unduly influenced by, I can't remember his name, the millionaire. And the reason people are upset is we want an independent judiciary. Inscribed over the doors of the United States Supreme Court are the words equal justice, under law. What that means is that when we the people, when we face this mysterious and majestic thing called the government, which if you think about it is simply a legal fiction, I'll talk about that in a moment. But when we face the government, the collective will, we want to be treated with respect. We want to be treated equally. That's the promise of democracy. That is, our claims evaluated independently of our relationship to others, and simply to be evaluated in terms of our relationship to the community. And so I think an independent judiciary, you know, you end up with when you have an elected judiciary, you have judges looking for votes. I think that influences their decision on how they're going to decide cases. And certainly that's democratic. But I remind your listeners and you that our federal constitution basically is a three-legged stool. We have a federal list system. In other words, we have a federal and state set of governments that power is diffuse. We have checks and balances, you know, the separation of powers. And we have the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights places certain things beyond the reach of government. And those who determine it, what the Bill of Rights means in the hard cases, are our judiciary. And I want them independent of the people. I want them independent of other branches of government. I want them to almost be a priestly vocation in the sense that their dedication is simply to the rule of law. And anything else that you introduce into that produces static in the system.
I want to run through a few different areas with you quickly because, you know, we do have a finite amount of time. So do I. Hey, I have 4 hours to fill a night. I get it. And I hope you'll come back and we can continue the discussion. But give me, beyond what we just mentioned as it relates to judges, some ways in which you think the criminal justice system can be improved for the administration of justice. Give me sort of your top five, if you have, ways that we can reform the system to do a better job doing justice for people.
Give judges the power to second guess the charging decisions of prosecutors. Prosecutors get to pick the charges, and then, you know, if the defendant can't get them dismissed because they're the evidence is insufficient, a judge can't substitute his sense of what's right for a prosecutor. So is a case overcharged? Is it negligent homicide and the prosecution's charged murder? Let the judge do that. Second, let the public observe plea bargaining. In many courtrooms and courthouses around the country, plea bargaining takes place behind closed doors. The First Amendment to the United States says there is a right of public access to the court. But the most important work being done in the courthouses is kept from the public view when people have private plea bargaining sessions. Third, and permit jury nullification. Because law is, and jury nullification is the ability of jurors to say that the prosecutors got it wrong, that they've applied the facts to the law or the law to the facts in ways that offend a community's sense of justice. There's a danger with that, obviously, you know, because a jury could engage in something that's unjust, for example, permitting race-based violence. Third, limit the time between when a criminal case is brought and when it goes to trial. The great delay of years works an injustice for the defendants held without bond and creates confusion in the community. And I suppose if I had to come up with five, a fifth would be to impose financial limitations to make sure the parties operated in a position of parity. The government has tremendous resources and can spend seemingly unlimited amounts when it thinks justice requires it. Defendants are often limited and public defender systems are overstrained. So there's built-in bias in favor of the government that tilts the system toward conviction. And I think sixth, pare down the criminal code. We just have too many laws, too many ways to lose your liberty.
We haven't spoken about this, but I'm going to go out on a limb and assume you're not a great fan of former President Trump. Now, maybe that's the case, maybe that's not the case, but a lot of folks are viewing what's happening to former President Trump on both the civil end of things and the criminal end of things as more of a persecution than someone that's committed those same acts would normally be going through. through. Give me your take on the Trump legal issues more broadly. Do you think he's being singled out because of politics? And on the civil case where President Trump was pretty steamed that he didn't get the chance to make his case before a jury, do you think that would have been a result that more people would have accepted had that been a jury result?
Let's start with that. The law recognizes claims of law and equity, and some claims that are equitable in nature, that they were rooted, for example, in the chancery courts in England. The common law arose in England, set of rules that are commonly applied to resolve disputes. Sometimes that law was silent and a dispute arose. The chancery courts got to apply it in a sense of justice. Those were non-jury courts. It's not entirely clear that the legal questions presented in the Trump case were civil case. Were not equitable in nature, meaning whether that he had a right to a jury trial. I think he did not have one. I'm not sure the results would have been any different, but I think that in terms of the legitimating role that a jury plays in rendering judgment, I think that it might have been more acceptable to many people had a jury rendered that judgment rather than the judge and his co-judge, his clerk. I'd never seen a clerk sit on the bench with a judge and participate mm-hmm. as this clerk mm-hmm. did. You know, as to Trump himself, I would vote for him, even though I don't like him. And I would vote for him at this point because I think he is the great canary in the American coal mine. There is a sickness in the land, a spiritual sickness in the land. And Trump reflects the anger about that and the angst about that. And I don't know what has become of our republic, whether it is disintegrating, meaning falling apart. I don't think we're necessarily on the cusp of civil war. But I think that if we can't learn to live together, we will learn to fight together and die together in ways that are unpleasant. Trump reflects that disaffection. And, you know, when people criticize him, I keep saying, it's not important what Trump says. Ask why he's saying it and why people are responding. And why are they responding? There's a lack of community, a lack of common purpose, a lack of a sense of unity in this country. And people are afraid. What are they afraid of? Let's focus less on the coal mine or the canary and more on the coal mine. What's he tweeting about? As to the overall legal landscape, you know, initially he changes lawyers so often, and he's such a difficult guy. He'd be a nightmare as a client. You know, I was thinking, all right, I'm musical chairs time. You know, my marriage is in disintegration, in large part because of the cases I've taken and the highly public and controversial character of them, and my outspokenness. You know, my wife has become a stranger to my wife as has she to me, and so on we go in this very broken world, and I'm not alone to have suffered at home as a result of all of these changes. So when I watch the legal cases arise, I was at first cynical, but I think Trump's team has pushed back pretty well. You know, you look at the Letitia James situation in Atlanta. I mean, clearly Letitia should not. Yeah, sorry about that.
Fannie Willis.
Fannie Willis. Thanks, I got mm-hmm. my names wrong.
Sure.
She needs to be out of office. I mean, clearly, you know, there was this the odor of malfeasance, I think, or of lack of candor. The judge wrote in that case. A prosecutor is a minister of justice. If they can't be trusted to tell the truth, they ought not to be in the case. The defense pushed back hard on that. I think they were right to do so, and they gained some ground. The documents case in Florida with Judge Cannon, again, the Trump team has raised interesting questions about the scope of the National Records Act and the Presidential Records Act, and whether he was entitled to keep these documents or not. With respect to the January 6th prosecutions, you know, those are some that I'm familiar with intimately because I was lead counsel for one of the leaders of the Proud Boys in the 5.5-month criminal sedition trial early in 2021. So I know this area of the law, you know. And I represented Alex Jones before the House Committee on January 6th. There was, simply put, no plan to engage in violence that day. What there were a series of pissed off people in Washington who responded to an angry president. And that president may or may not have lied to the people. But when the commander in chief says your election is stolen, I can imagine no more dire threat to the republic than that. People went to the Capitol. They were agitated. The mob broke and bad things occurred. And some of it was felonious. But to go from there to say that the temple of democracy was attacked, that the republic was teetering on its edge, it's a bunch of bullpucky. I remember having one of the cooperating witnesses, a former leader of the Proud Boys, on the witness stand. And I said, you know, which one of you geniuses was going to be Secretary of Transportation? Who was going to do banking, you know? And they didn't have a clue. They were just upset.
Norm, let me just ask you about this, because I can't have the opportunity to talk with you without getting you to explain what's going on with folks. You mentioned your representation of Alex Jones. Alex Jones obviously was on the receiving end of one of the largest civil judgments any media commentator has ever been found against, when he was making those remarks about the Sandy Hook families. Putting aside the ethics of what he said, the morality of what he said, you were suspended from practicing law in your state for 6 months, they said, for improperly giving Jones's other attorneys in Texas confidential documents, including the medical records of relatives of the victims of the Sandy Hook shooting. Can you explain what your legal status is these days, and what about the judge's decision regarding you was improper, if anything?
So I began to represent Alex Jones in March of 2019 in the Sandy Hook cases, and he was defaulted along the way for failure to comply with discovery. Jones operates a complex business, 80-some employees, but no answering machine, no common phone system, you know, no real reporting structure. It's just sheer chaos down there. But yet he moves millions of dollars through his business, selling his products, and millions of people listen to him and hang on his every word. He's got charisma, the gift of God, the God's breath, as it were. I'm not saying he speaks for God, mm-hmm. but I'm saying he draws mm-hmm. an audience. So we gathered, and another firm participated in the mechanics of the discovery of information, including medical records about the Sandy Hook plaintiffs. There was a protective order in place that said no lawyer who was in possession of such documents could share them with anybody unless that person was, quote, counsel of record, or that person signed a confidentiality agreement. Jones had a company move into bankruptcy as a result of these prejudgment claims, and that bankruptcy lawyer and I were working, that was a Texas bankruptcy lawyer. That Texas bankruptcy lawyer and I were working together to protect Jones' interest in claims related to Sandy Hook. He made an urgent request for records, the records in the case, and we gave them to him, taking him to be counsel of record in that way, although it wasn't of record, technically speaking, in Connecticut. But he had similar interests and the same posture. It was Jones against the Sandy Hook plaintiffs. That lawyer, in turn, gave them to a lawyer in Texas who was representing Jones against other Sandy Hook cases in the Texas litigation. That Texas lawyer's paralegal mistakenly sent the medical records to the plaintiff's lawyers in the Texas litigation, and he used them to create a Perry Mason type moment on national television. Mm-hmm. My judge read that, and when I heard that, I thought, gosh, we must have given him the records. How else could he have gotten them? She held a hearing for me to show cause as to why I should not be held in contempt or otherwise disciplined for sharing the records. Our defense was that it was authorized under the protective agreement as we understood it. She viewed that as an entirely irresponsible reading of that, and when called to testify, for reasons that I won't disclose, I pled the Fifth Amendment rather than answer her questions. So the result was that she suspended me for a period of 6 months, effective immediately. That went on during jury selection in the Proud Boys case. And so we got the suspension order stayed, in other words, put on ice, while we take an appeal to the appellate courts. So my appeal was argued on January 2nd of this year, and any day now we'll get a decision. And I may or may not get a 6-month vacation. So, I'm on pins and needles.
I can't imagine. Norm, I do hope you'll come back. I always enjoy talking with you. I always learn a great deal, and I appreciate your advocacy for the jury system. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you're welcome to give me a call, 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Thank God it's
It is Friday indeed. Good Friday, no less. You know, it's funny, a lot of people have the day off today. And maybe that's causing a lot of people who normally are asleep right now to be awake and listening to our program and sampling it for the first time. If that's the case, wonderful. That's great. Give me a call. Let me hear from you. 800-848-9222. I'm going to be heading to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Where else would you go on Holy Weekend than Bethlehem? I'm going to see my Aunt Madeline, who had a birthday this week, and all my cousins. And I'm looking forward to seeing everybody. That'll be fun. Last night, I had the first drink that I'd had in 40 days. I actually had two. I had a martini, and then at the restaurant that we were at, I also had a glass of wine, which was pretty good. You know, honestly, I really didn't find myself jonesing for it. I tell this to some people, and maybe this is an indication that I really am some sort of an alcoholic. I find it much easier to not drink alcohol than I do to drink in moderation. And that's the case with everything. Carbs, cheese, sugar. I find it much easier just to give up something than to say, I'm going to have a glass of wine once a week. So that was that's why I never did this Sunday indulgence thing. You know, it's funny. So our church, we go to an Episcopal church, and they're going to have the Easter Bunny there on Sunday. And, you know, it's exciting. We went last year, and Carmine was first gaining an appreciation for what the Easter Bunny did, and they have eggs and that kind of thing. But I mentioned this to some of my cousins when I saw them last weekend, and they thought, because, you know, growing up, we never had the Easter Bunny at church. I grew up going to a Catholic church. And they thought this was awful. They thought this was the most unreligious thing ever, that the Easter Bunny has no place. Now, he's not sitting there in the church service, but he's there outside the church, and he takes pictures with kids. He greets the kids, and there's an Easter egg hunt. And some people had a little bit of a problem with it, it seemed. I don't. I think it's kind of festive. I think it's kind of fun. And I know my 2-year-old is certainly looking forward to it. So that's what's on our agenda for the weekend. And I am excited that baseball is back. You know, there's something. I don't follow baseball the way that I did when I was 10. But there is still something so magical about the beginning of baseball season. It's really, I find it so good for the soul. And watching baseball, especially once the weather starts to get nice, even if you're just watching the games on TV, that's why one of the reasons I wish there were more day games, not only because I happen to be preparing for the show a lot at night these days, but there's something that is so much fun about watching a baseball game at the beginning of the season. It signals kind of the beginning of spring. And it really lessens the feelings of loneliness, I think,
that a lot of folks end up dealing with in the winter. We've talked about that. So I'm excited the baseball season is here. And as a Met fan, I am already bracing myself for the inevitable disappointment that will somehow come my way one way or another. All right, 800-848-9222, 800-848-9222. Oh, before I get to your calls, I saw a very interesting article yesterday, and it has to do with dementia, namely preventing dementia. I am, you know, I've prided myself a great deal on my memory. I think I have a pretty good memory, especially for certain things. And I'm just terrified at the prospect. Even sometimes when I can't remember something, a name or a fact, I get a little alarmed. Now, I try to remain calm because, you know, that they say that doesn't help anything is to freak out over anything. But they say there are three things that can be done to avoid dementia, according to this new study. They studied, 150-something contributing factors to dementia. And we've talked a lot about dementia specifically in light of what's going on with Wendy Williams, in light of what's going on with Bruce Willis. And the three things, number one, less alcohol, which, you know, goes against the grain with what I mentioned yesterday or just a minute ago. Two, reducing sugar intake. Three, and I never would have guessed this. If you would have given me 100 guesses, I would not have guessed this. Reducing traffic pollution. Would you ever have guessed that? They say this new study that those three factors, sugar, traffic-related air pollution, and alcohol contribute significantly to your risk of dementia. So, I don't know. Maybe I'll be moving to Montana, or if the rumors of Wyoming's existence are true, maybe I'll be heading there. Who knows? I'm not really going to do that. I'll deal with the traffic. All right. 800-848-9222. We'll get to your calls and more, including denunciations. Looking forward to that. In the words of the great Bob Barker, help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is Greg Kelly for Priority Gold. What does it mean to be America's precious metals dealer? It means that you're in touch with the hearts and minds of those who love this country, value our freedom, and want to protect the future. Priority Gold is that precious metals dealer. They've helped thousands of Americans back their retirement with solid gold and silver. Call Priority Gold at 888-506-6439. Receive free shipping, free storage, a free investment guide, and one of the best purchase experiences in the industry. Call now or go to PriorityGold.com.